Act 1. I Contain Multitudes. Chapter 1. Chuck was looking forward to having a baby sister. His mother promised he could hold her if he was very careful. Of course, he was also looking forward to having parents, but none of that worked out thanks to an icy patch on an I-95 overpass. Much later in college, he would tell a girlfriend that there were all sorts of novels, movies, and TV shows where main characters' parents died in a car crash, but he was the only person he knew who'd had that happen in real life. The girlfriend thought this over, then rendered her verdict. "I'm sure it happens all the time, although partners can also be taken in house fires, tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, and avalanches while on ski vacations, to name only a few of the possibilities. And what makes you think you're a main character in anything but your own mind?" She was a poet and sort of a nihilist. The relationship only lasted a semester. Chuck wasn't in the car when it went flying upside down from the turnpike overpass because his parents were having a dinner date and he was being babysat by his grandparents, who at the time he was still calling Zadie and Bubby. This mostly ended in the third grade when kids made fun of him and he reverted to the more all-American grandma and grandpa. Albie and Sarah Krantz lived just a mile down the road, and it was natural enough for them to raise him after the accident when he became what he first believed to be an orphaned. He was 7. For a year, maybe a year and a half, that was a house of unadulterated sadness. The Krantzes had not only lost their son and daughter-in-law, they had lost the granddaughter who would have been born just 3 months later. The name had already been picked out, Alyssa. When Chuck said that sounded to him like rain, his mother had laughed and cried at the same time. He never forgot that. He knew his other grandparents, of course. There were visits every summer, but they were basically strangers to him. They called a lot after he became an orphaned. Your basic "how are you doing, how's school" calls and the summer visits continued. Sarah, aka Bubby, aka Grandma, took him on the plane. But his mother's parents remained strangers, living in the foreign land of Omaha. They sent him presents on his birthday and at Christmas, the latter especially nice since Grandma and Grandpa didn't do Christmas. But otherwise he continued to think of them as outliers, like the teachers who were left behind as he moved up through the grades. Chuck began to slip his metaphorical mourning garments first, necessarily pulling his grandparents, old, yeah, but not ancient, out of their own grief. There came a time when Chuck was 10 that they took the boy to Disney World. They had adjoining rooms at the Swan Resort. The door between the rooms kept open at night, and Chuck only heard his grandma crying once. Mostly, they had fun. Some of that good feeling came back home with them. Chuck sometimes heard Grandma humming in the kitchen or singing along with the radio. There had been lots of takeout meals after the accident and whole recyclable bins full of Grandpa's Budweiser bottles. But in the year after Disney World, Grandma began cooking again. Good meals that put weight on a formerly skinny boy. She liked rock and roll while she was cooking. Music, Chuck would have thought, much too young for her, but which she clearly enjoyed. If Chuck wandered into the kitchen looking for a cookie or maybe hoping to make a brown sugar roll-up with a slice of Wonder Bread, Grandma was apt to hold out her hands to him and start snapping her fingers. "Dance with me, Henry," she'd say. His name was Chuck, not Henry, but he usually took her up on it. She taught him jitterbug steps and a couple of crossover moves. She told him there were more, but her back was too creaky to attempt them. "I can show you, though," she said, and one Saturday brought back a stack of videotapes from the Blockbuster store. There was Swing Time with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, West Side Story, and Chuck's favorite, Singin' in the Rain, where Gene Kelly danced with a lamppost. "You could learn those moves," she said. "You're a natural, kiddo." He asked her once, when they were drinking iced tea after an especially strenuous go to Jackie Wilson's Higher and Higher, what she had been like in high school.
"I was a cousite," she said. "But don't tell your Zadie I said that. He's old school, that one."
Chuck never told, and he never went in the cupola. Not then. He asked about it, of course, and more than once. What was up there, what you could see from the high window, why the room was locked. Grandma said it was because the floor wasn't safe and he might go right through it. Grandpa said the same thing, that there was nothing up there because of the rotten floor, and the only thing you could see from those windows was a shopping center, big deal. He said that until one night, just before Chuck's 11th birthday, when he told at least part of the truth. Chapter 2. Drinking is not good for secrets. Everybody knows that, and after the death of his son, daughter-in-law, and granddaughter-to-be, Alyssa sounds like rain. Albie Krantz drank a great deal. He should have bought stock in Anheuser-Busch. That was how much he drank. He could do it because he was retired and comfortably off and very depressed. After the trip to Disney World, the drinking tapered off to a glass of wine with dinner or a beer in front of a baseball game. Mostly. Once in a while, every month at first, every couple of months later on, Chuck's grandpa tied one on, always at home and never making any fuss about it. The next day he would move slowly and eat little until afternoon. Then he was back to normal. One night, while watching the Red Sox get thumped by the Yankees, when Albie was well into his second six-pack of Bud, Chuck once more raised the subject of the cupola, mostly just to have something to talk about. With the Sox down by 9, the game wasn't exactly holding his attention.
"I bet you can see way past the Westford Mall," Chuck said.
Grandpa considered this, then pushed the mute button on the TV controller, silencing an ad for Ford Truck Month. Grandpa said Ford stood for Fix or Repair Daily.
"If you went up there, you might see a lot more than you wanted," he said.
"That's why it's locked, Boychick."
Chuck felt a small and not entirely unpleasurable chill go through him, and his mind immediately flashed to Scooby-Doo and his friends chasing down spooks in the Mystery Machine. He wanted to ask what Grandpa meant, but the adult part of him, not there in person, no, not at 10, but something that had begun to speak on rare occasions, told him to be quiet. Be quiet and wait.
"Do you know what style this house is, Chucky?"
"Victorian," Chuck said.
"That's right. And not pretend Victorian, either. It was built in 1885, been remodeled half a dozen times since, but the cupola was there from the start. Your Bobby and I bought it when the shoe business really took off, and we got it for a song. Been here since 1971, and in all those years, I haven't been up to that damn cupola half a dozen times."
"Because the floor's rotted?" Chuck asked, with what he hoped was appealing innocence.
"Because it's full of ghosts," Grandpa said, and Chuck felt that chill again.
Not so pleasurable this time. Although Grandpa might be joking, he did joke from time to time these days. Jokes were to Grandpa what dancing was to Grandma. He tipped his beer, belched. His eyes were red.
"Christmas yet to come. Do you remember that one, Chucky?"
Chuck did. They watched A Christmas Carol every year on Christmas Eve, even though they didn't do Christmas otherwise, but that didn't mean he knew what Grandpa was talking about.
"The Jeffries boy was only a short time later," Grandpa said.
He was looking at the TV, but Chuck didn't think he was actually seeing it.
What happened to Henry Peterson? That took longer. It was 4, maybe 5 years on. By then I'd almost forgotten what I saw up there. He jerked a thumb at the ceiling. I said I'd never go up there again after that, and I wish I hadn't. Because of Sarah, your bubby, and the bread. It's the waiting, Chucky. That's the hard part. You'll find that out when you're...
The kitchen door opened. It was Grandma, back from Mrs. Stanley's across the street. Grandma had taken her chicken soup because Mrs. Stanley was feeling poorly. So Grandma said, anyway. But even at not quite 11, Chuck had a good idea there was another reason. Mrs. Stanley knew all the neighborhood gossip.
She's a yenta, that one,
Grandpa said, and was always willing to share. Grandma poured all the news out to Grandpa, usually after inviting Chuck out of the room. But out of the room didn't mean out of earshot.
Who was Henry Peterson, Grandpa?
Chuck asked. But Grandpa had heard his wife come in. He straightened up in his chair and put his can of Bud aside.
Look at that, he cried in a passable imitation of sobriety. Not that Grandma would be fooled. The Sox have got the bases loaded.
Chapter 3. In the top of the eighth, Grandma sent Grandpa down to the Zonies Go Mart at the bottom of the block to get milk for Chuck's Applejacks in the morning.
And don't even think of driving. The walk will sober you up.
Grandpa didn't argue. With Grandma, he rarely did, and when he gave it a try, the results weren't good. When he was gone, Grandma, Bubby, sat down next to Chuck on the couch and put an arm around him. Chuck put his head on her comfortably padded shoulder.
Was he babbling to you about his ghosts? The ones that live in the cupola?
Yeah.
There was no point in telling a lie. Grandma saw right through those.
Are there? Have you seen them?
Grandma snorted.
What do you think, Huntle?
Later, it would occur to Chuck that this wasn't an answer.
I wouldn't pay too much attention to Zadie. He's a good man, but sometimes he drinks a little too much. Then he rides his hobby horses. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Chuck did. Nixon should have gone to jail. The Fagelas were taking over American culture and turning it pink. The Miss America pageant, which Grandma loved, was your basic meat show. But he had never said anything about ghosts in the cupola before that night. At least to Chuck.
Bubby, who was the Jeffries boy?
She sighed.
That was a very sad thing, boy Chuck.
This was her little joke.
He lived on the next block over and got hit by a drunk driver when he chased a ball into the street. It happened a long time ago. If your grandpa told you he saw it before it happened, he was mistaken, or making it up for one of his jokes.
Grandma knew when Chuck was lying. On that night, Chuck discovered that was a talent that could go both ways. It was all in the way she stopped looking at him and shifted her eyes to the television, as if what was going on there was interesting when Chuck knew Grandma didn't give a hang for baseball, not even the World Series.
He just drinks too much, Grandma said,
and that was the end of it. Maybe true, probably true, but after that Chuck was frightened of the cupola. With its locked door at the top of a short 6 steps flight of narrow stairs lit by a single bare bulb hanging on a black cord. But fascination is fear's twin brother, and sometimes after that night, if both of his grandparents were out, he dared himself to climb them. He would touch the Yale padlock, wincing if it rattled, a sound that might disturb the ghosts pent up inside.
then hurried back down the stairs, looking over his shoulder as he went. It was easy to imagine the lock popping open and dropping to the floor, the door creaking open on its unused hinges. If that happened, he guessed he might die of fright. Chapter 4. The cellar, on the other hand, wasn't a bit scary. It was brightly lighted by fluorescents. After selling his shoe stores and retiring, Grandpa spent a lot of time down there doing woodwork. It always smelled sweetly of sawdust. In one corner, far from the planers and sanders and the bandsaw he was forbidden to touch, Chuck found a box of Grandpa's old Hardy Boys books. They were old-timey, but pretty good. He was reading the sinister signpost one day in the kitchen, waiting for Grandma to remove a batch of cookies from the oven, when she grabbed the book out of his hands.
"You can do better than that," she said. "Time to step up your game, boy Chuck. Wait right here."
"I was just getting to the good part," Chuck said. She snorted, a sound to which only Jewish bubbies do true justice.
"There are no good parts in these," she said, and took the book away.
What she came back with was The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
"Now this is a good mystery story," she said. "No dummix teenagers running around in jalopies. Consider this your introduction to actual writing."
She considered.
"Okay, so not Saul Bellow, but not bad."
Chuck started the book just to please Grandma and was soon lost. In his 11th year, he read almost 24 Agatha Christies. He tried a couple about Miss Marple, but he was much fonder of Hercule Poirot with his fussy mustache and little gray cells. Poirot was one thinking cat. One day during his summer vacation, Chuck was reading Murder on the Orient Express in the backyard hammock and happened to glance up at the window of the cupola far above. He wondered how Monsieur Poirot would go about investigating it. "Aha," he thought, and then voila, which was better. The next time Grandma made blueberry muffins, Chuck asked if he could take some to Mrs. Stanley.
"That's very thoughtful of you," Grandma said. "Why don't you do that? Just remember to look both ways when you cross the street."
She always told him that when he was going somewhere. Now, with his little gray cells engaged, he wondered if she was thinking of the Jeffries boy. Grandma was plump and getting plumper, but Mrs. Stanley was twice her size, a widow who wheezed like a leaky tire when she walked and always seemed to be dressed in the same pink silk wrapper. Chuck felt vaguely guilty about bringing her treats that would add to her girth, but he needed information. She thanked him for the muffins and asked, as he'd been pretty sure she would, if he would like to have one with her in the kitchen.
"I could make tea."
"Thank you," Chuck said. "I don't drink tea, but I wouldn't mind a glass of milk." When they were seated at the little kitchen table in a flood of June sunshine, Mrs. Stanley asked how things were going with Albie and Sarah. Chuck, mindful that anything he said in this kitchen would be on the street before the day was out, said they were doing fine. But because Poirot said you had to give a little if you wanted to get a little, he added that Grandma was collecting clothes for the Lutheran homeless shelter.
"Your grandma's a saint,"
Mrs. Stanley said, obviously disappointed there wasn't more.
"What about your granddad? Did he get that thing on his back looked at?"
"Yeah," Chuck said. He took a sip of milk. "The doctor took it off and had it tested. It wasn't one of the bad ones."
"Thank God for that."
"Yes," Chuck agreed. Having given, he now felt entitled to get. "He was talking with Grandma about someone named Henry Peterson. I guess he's dead." He was prepared for disappointment. She might have never heard of Henry Peterson, but Mrs. Stanley widened her eyes until Chuck was actually afraid they might fall out and grasped her neck like she had a piece of blueberry muffin stuck in there.
Oh, that was so sad. So awful. He was the bookkeeper who did your father's accounts, you know. Other companies, too.
She leaned forward, her wrapper giving Chuck a view of a bosom so large it seemed hallucinatory. She was still clutching her neck.
He killed himself, she whispered. Hung himself.
Was he embezzling?
Chuck asked. There was a lot of embezzling in Agatha Christie books, also blackmail.
What? God, no.
She pressed her lips together, as if to keep in something not fit for the ears of such a beardless youth as the one sitting across from her. If that was the case, her natural proclivity to tell everything and to anyone prevailed.
His wife ran away with a younger man, hardly old enough to vote, and she was in her 40s. What do you think of that?
The only reply Chuck could think of right off the bat was, "Wow," and that seemed to suffice. Back at home, he pulled his notebook off the shelf and jotted, "G saw ghost of Jeffrey's boy not long before he died. Saw ghost of H. Peterson 4 or 5 years before he died." Chuck stopped, chewing the end of his Bic, troubled. He didn't want to write what was in his mind, but felt that, as a good detective, he had to. Sarah and the bread. Did he see Grandma's ghost in the cupola? The answer seemed obvious to him. Why else would Grandpa have talked about how hard the waiting was? Now I'm waiting too, Chuck thought, and hoping that it's all just a bunch of bullshit. Chapter 5. On the last day of sixth grade, Miss Richards, a sweet, hippy-dippy-ish young woman who had no command of discipline and would probably not last long in the public education system, tried to read Chuck's class some verses of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. It didn't go well. The kids were rowdy and didn't want poetry, only to escape into the months of summer stretching ahead. Chuck was the same, happy to throw spitballs or give Mike Enderby the finger when Miss Richards was looking down at her book. But one line clanged in his head and made him sit up straight. When the class was finally over and the kids set free, he lingered. Miss Richards sat at her desk and blew a strand of hair back from her forehead. When she saw Chuck still standing there, she gave him a weary smile. That went well, don't you think? Chuck knew sarcasm when he heard it, even when the sarcasm was gentle and self-directed. He was Jewish, after all. Well, half. What does that mean when he says, "I am large, I contain multitudes"? That made her smile perk up. She propped one small fist on her chin and looked at him with her pretty gray eyes. What do you think it means? All the people he knows? Chuck ventured. Yes, she agreed. But maybe he means even more. Lean forward. He leaned over her desk where American verse lay on top of her gradebook. Very gently, she put her palms to his temples. They were cool. They felt so wonderful he had to suppress a shiver. What's in there between my hands? Just the people you know? More, Chuck said. He was thinking of his mother and father and the baby he never got a chance to hold. Alyssa sounds like rain. Memories. Yes, she said. Everything you see, everything you know, the world, Chucky. Planes in the sky, manhole covers in the street. Every year you live, that world inside your head will get bigger and brighter, more detailed and complex. Do you understand? I think so, Chuck said. He was overwhelmed with the thought of a whole world inside the fragile bowl of his skull. He thought of the Jeffries boy hid in the street. He thought of Henry Peterson, his father's bookkeeper, dead at the end of a rope. He'd had nightmares about that. Their worlds going dark, like a room when you turned out the light. Miss Richards took her hands away. She looked concerned.
Are you all right, Chucky?
Yes, he said. Then go on.
You're a good boy. I've enjoyed having you in class.
He went to the door, then turned back.
Miss Richards, do you believe in ghosts?
She considered this.
I believe memories are ghosts, but spooks flapping along the halls of musty castles? I think those only exist in books and movies.
And maybe in the cupola of Grandpa's house, Chuck thought.
Enjoy your summer, Chucky.
Chapter 6 Chuck did enjoy his summer, until August, when Grandma died. It happened down the street, in public, which was a little undignified, but at least it was the kind of death where people can safely say, thank God she didn't suffer at the funeral. That other standby, she had a long, full life, was in more of a gray area. Sarah Krantz had yet to reach her mid-60s, although she was getting close. Once more, the house on Pilchard Street was one of unadulterated sadness. Only this time, there was no trip to Disney World to mark the beginning of recovery. Chuck reverted to calling Grandma his Bubby, at least in his own head, and cried himself to sleep on many nights. He did it with his face in his pillow so he wouldn't make Grandpa feel even worse. Sometimes he whispered, Bubby, I miss you. Bubby, I love you. Until sleep finally took him. Grandpa wore his mourning band and lost weight and stopped telling his jokes and began to look older than his 70 years. But Chuck also sensed, or thought he did, some relief in his grandpa. If so, Chuck could understand. When you lived with dread day in and day out, there had to be relief when the dreaded thing finally happened and was over. Didn't there? He didn't go up the steps to the cupola after she died, daring himself to touch the padlock, but he did go down to Zoni's one day just before starting 7th grade at Acker Park Middle School. He bought a soda and a Kit Kat bar, then asked the clerk where the woman was when she had her stroke and died. The clerk, an over-tatted 20-something with a lot of greased-back blonde hair, gave an unpleasant laugh. Kid, that's a little creepy. Are you, I don't know, brushing up on your serial killer skills early?
She was my grandma, Chuck said. My Bubby. I was at the community pool when it happened. I came back in the house calling for her, and Grandpa told me she was dead.
That wiped the smile off the clerk's face.
Oh, man, I'm sorry. It was over there, 3rd aisle.
Chuck went to the 3rd aisle and looked, already knowing what he would see.
She was getting a loaf of bread, the clerk said. Pulled down almost everything on the shelf when she collapsed. Sorry if that's too much information.
No, Chuck said and thought, that's information I already knew.
Chapter 7 On his second day at Acker Park Middle, Chuck walked past the bulletin board by the main office, then doubled back. Among the posters for pep club, band, and tryouts for the fall sports teams, there was one showing a boy and a girl caught in mid-dance step, he holding his hand up so she could spin beneath. Learn to dance, it said above the smiling children in rainbow letters. Below it, join twirlers and spinners. Fall fling is coming. Get out on the floor. An image of painful clarity came to Chuck as he looked at this. Grandma in the kitchen, holding her hands out, snapping her fingers and saying, dance with me, Henry. That afternoon, he went down to the gymnasium, where he and 9 hesitant others were greeted enthusiastically by Miss Rohrbacher, the girls' phys ed teacher. Chuck was one of 3 boys, There were 7 girls. All the girls were taller. One of the boys, Paul Mulford, tried to creep out as soon as he realized he was the smallest kid there, coming in at 5 feet nothing. Miss Rohrbacher chased him down and hauled him back, laughing cheerfully.
"No, no, no," she said. "You're mine now."
So he was. So they all were. Miss Rohrbacher was the dance monster, and none could stand in her way. She fired up her boombox and showed them the waltz. Chuck knew it. And cha-cha. Chuck knew it. The ball change. Chuck knew it. Then the samba. Chuck didn't know that one, but when Miss Rohrbacher put on Tequila by the Champs and showed them the basic moves, he got it at once and fell in love with it. He was by far the best dancer in the little club, so Miss Rohrbacher mostly put him with the girls who were clumsy. He understood she did it to make them better, and he was a good sport about it, but it was sort of boring. Near the end of their 45 minutes, however, the dance monster would show mercy and pair him with Kat McCoy, who was an 8th grader and the best dancer of the girls. Chuck didn't expect romance. Kat was not only gorgeous, she was 4 inches taller than he was, but he loved to dance with her, and the feeling was mutual. When they got together, they caught the rhythm and let it fill them. They looked into each other's eyes. She had to look down, which was a bummer, but hey, it was what it was, and laughed for the joy of it. Before letting the kids go, Miss Rohrbacher paired them up. 4 of the girls had to dance with each other, and told them to freestyle. As they lost their inhibitions and awkwardness, they all got pretty good at it, although most of them were never going to dance at the Copacabana. One day, this was in October, only a week or so before the fall fling, Miss Rohrbacher put on Billie Jean. "Watch this," Chuck said, and did a very passable moonwalk. The kids oohed. Miss Rohrbacher's mouth dropped open. "Oh my God," Kat said. "Show me how you did that." He did it again. Kat tried, but the illusion of walking backward just wasn't there. "Kick off your shoes," Chuck said. "Do it in your socks. Slide into it." Kat did. It was much better, and they all applauded. Miss Rohrbacher had a go. Then all of the others were moonwalking like crazy. Even Dylan Masterson, the clumsiest of them, got into it. Twirlers and spinners let out 30 minutes later than usual that day. Chuck and Kat walked out together.
"We should do it at the fling," she said.
Chuck, who hadn't been planning on going, stopped and looked at her with his eyebrows raised.
"Not as a date or anything," Kat hastened on. "I'm going out with Dougie Wentworth."
This Chuck knew.
"But that doesn't mean we couldn't show them some cool moves. I want to, don't you?"
"I don't know," Chuck said. "I'm a lot shorter. I think people would laugh."
"Got you covered," Kat said. "My brother's got a pair of Cuban heels, and I think they'd fit you. You've got big feet for a little kid."
"Thanks a bunch," Chuck said. She laughed and gave him a sisterly hug. At the next meeting of twirlers and spinners, Kat McCoy brought her brother's Cubans. Chuck, who had already endured slights to his manhood for being in the dance club, was prepared to hate them, but it was love at first sight. The heels were high, the toes were pointed, and they were black as midnight in Moscow. They looked a lot like the ones Bo Diddley wore back in the day. So, okay, they were a little big, but toilet paper stuffed into those pointy toes took care of that. Best of all, man, they were slick. During freestyle, when Miss Rohrbacher put on Caribbean Queen, the gym floor felt like ice.
"You put scratches on that floor, the janitors will beat your butt,"
Tammy Underwood said. She was probably right, but there were no scratches. He was too light on his feet to leave any. Chapter 8. Chuck went stag to the fall fling, which turned out just fine because all the girls from Twirlers and Spinners wanted to dance with him. especially Kat, because her boyfriend, Dougie Wentworth, had two left feet and spent most of the evening slouched against the wall with his buddies, all of them sucking up punch and watching the dancers with lordly sneers. Kat kept asking him when they were going to do their stuff, and Chuck kept putting her off. He said he'd know the right tune when he heard it. It was his bubby he was thinking of. Around 9 o'clock, half an hour or so before the dance was scheduled to end, the right tune came up. It was Jackie Wilson singing Higher and Higher. Chuck strutted to Kat with his hands out. She kicked off her shoes, and with Chuck in her brother's Cubans, they were at least close to the same height. They went out on the floor, and when they did a double moonwalk, they cleared it. The kids made a circle around them and began clapping. Miss Rohrbacher, one of the chaperones, was among them, clapping along with the rest and shouting, "Go, go, go!" They did. As Jackie Wilson shouted that happy gospel-tinged tune, they danced like Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, Gene Kelly, and Jennifer Beals, all rolled up into one. They finished with Kat spinning first one way, then the other, then collapsing backward into Chuck's arms with her own held out in a dying swan. He went down in a split that miraculously didn't rip the crotch out of his pants. 200 kids cheered when Kat turned her head and put a kiss on the corner of Chuck's mouth. "One more time," some kid shouted, but Chuck and Kat shook their heads. They were young, but smart enough to know when to quit. The best cannot be topped. Chapter 9. 6 months before he died of a brain tumor, at the unfair age of 39, and while his mind was still working, mostly, Chuck told his wife the truth about the scar on the back of his hand. It wasn't a big deal and hadn't been a big lie, but he'd reached a time in his rapidly diminishing life when it seemed important to clear the books. The only time she'd asked about it, it really was a very small scar, he told her that he had gotten it from a boy named Doug Wentworth, who was pissed about him cavorting with his girlfriend at a middle school dance and pushed him into a chain-link fence outside the gymnasium. "What actually happened?" Ginny asked, not because it was important to her, but because it seemed to be important to him. She didn't care much about whatever had happened to him in middle school. The doctor said he would probably be dead before Christmas. That was what mattered to her. When their fabulous dance was over and the DJ put on another more recent tune, Kat McCoy had run to her girlfriends, who giggled and shrieked and hugged her with a fervency of which only 13-year-old girls may be capable. Chuck was sweaty and so hot his cheeks felt on the verge of catching fire. He was also euphoric. All he wanted in that moment was darkness, cool air, and to be by himself. He walked past Dougie and his friends, who paid absolutely no attention to him, like a boy in a dream, pushed through the door at the back of the gym, and walked out into the paved half-court. The cool fall air doused the fire in his cheeks, but not the euphoria. He looked up, saw a million stars, and understood that for each one of those million, there was another million behind it. "The universe is large," he thought. "It contains multitudes. It also contains me. And in this moment, I am wonderful. I have a right to be wonderful." He moonwalked under the basketball hoop, moving to the music inside. When he made his little confession to Ginny, he could no longer remember what that music had been. But for the record, it was the Steve Miller Band, Jet Airliner. And then twirled, his arms outstretched, as if to embrace everything. There was pain in his right hand. Not big pain, just your basic ouch, but it was enough to bring him out of his joyous elevation of spirit and back to earth. He saw that the back of his hand was bleeding. While he was doing his whirling dervish bit under the stars, his outflung hand had struck the chain-link fence and a protruding jut of wire had cut him. It was a superficial wound, hardly enough to merit a band-aid. It left a scar, though, a tiny white crescent scar.
"Why would you lie about that?"
Ginny asked. She was smiling as she picked up his hand and kissed the scar. "I could understand it if you'd gone on to tell me how you beat the big bully to a pulp, but you never said that." No, he'd never said that, and he'd never had a bit of trouble with Dougie Wentworth. For one thing, he was a cheerful enough galoot. For another, Chuck Krantz was a seventh-grade midget, unworthy of notice. Why had he told the lie, then, if not to cast himself as the hero of a fictional story? Because the scar was important for another reason. Because it was part of a story he couldn't tell, even though there was now an apartment building standing on the site of the Victorian house where he had done most of his growing up. The haunted Victorian house. The scar meant more, so he had made it more. He just couldn't make it as much more as it really was. That made little sense. But as the glioblastoma continued its blitzkrieg, it was the best his disintegrating mind could manage. He had finally told her the truth of how the scar actually happened, and that would have to do. Chapter 10. Chuck's grandpa, his Zadie, died of a heart attack 4 years after the Fall Fling dance. It happened while Albie was climbing the steps of the public library to return a copy of The Grapes of Wrath, which he said was every bit as good as he remembered. Chuck was a junior in high school, singing in a band and dancing like Jagger during the instrumental breaks. Grandpa left him everything. The estate, once quite large, had shrunk considerably over the years since Grandpa's early retirement, but they were still enough to pay for Chuck's college education. Later on, the sale of the Victorian paid for the house, small but in a good neighborhood with a lovely back room for a nursery, he and Virginia moved into after their honeymoon in the Catskills. As a new hire at Midwest Trust, a humble teller, he never could have bought the place without Grandpa's inheritance. Chuck flatly refused to move to Omaha to live with his mother's parents. "I love you guys," he said, "but this is where I grew up and where I want to stay until I go to college. I'm 17, not a baby." So they, both long retired, came to him and stayed in the Victorian with him for the 20 months or so before Chuck went off to the University of Illinois. They weren't able to be there for the funeral and burial, however. It happened fast, as Grandpa had wanted, and his mom's folks had loose ends to tie up in Omaha. Chuck didn't really miss them. He was surrounded by friends and neighbors he knew much better than his mother's goy parents. A day before they were scheduled to arrive, Chuck finally opened a manila envelope that had been sitting on the table in the front hall. It was from the Ebert Holloway Funeral Parlor. Inside were Albie Krantz's personal effects, at least those that had been in his pockets when he collapsed on the library steps. Chuck dumped the envelope out on the table. There was a rattle of coins, a few Hall's cough drops, a pocket knife, the new cell phone Grandpa had barely had a chance to use, and his wallet. Chuck picked up the wallet, smelled its old limp leather, kissed it, and cried a little. He was an orphan now, for sure. There was also Grandpa's key ring. Chuck slipped this over the index finger of his right hand, the one with the crescent-shaped scar, and climbed the short and shadowy flight of stairs to the cupola. This last time, he did more than rattle the Yale padlock. After some searching, he found the right key and unlocked it. He left the lock hanging from the hasp and pushed the door open, wincing at the squeal of the old, unoiled hinges, ready for anything. Chapter 11. But there was nothing. The room was empty. It was small, circular, no more than 14 feet in diameter, maybe less. On the far side was a single wide window, caked with the dirt of years. Although the day was sunny, the light it let in was bleary and diffuse. Standing on the threshold, Chuck put out a foot and toed the boards like a boy testing the water of a pond to see if it was cold. There was no creak, no give. He stepped in, ready to leap back the moment he felt the floor start to sag, but it was solid. He walked across to the window, leaving footprints in the thick fall of dust. Grandpa had been lying about the rotted floor, but about the view he had been dead on. It really wasn't much. Chuck could see the shopping center beyond the greenbelt, and beyond that, an Amtrak train moving toward the city, pulling a stump tail of 5 passenger cars. At this time of day, with the morning commuter rush over, there would be few riders. Chuck stood at the window until the train was gone, then followed his footprints back to the door. As he turned to close it, he saw a bed in the middle of the circular room. It was a hospital bed. There was a man in it. He appeared to be unconscious. There were no machines, but Chuck could hear one just the same, going, "Bip, bip, bip." A heart monitor, maybe. There was a table beside the bed. On it were various lotions and a pair of black-framed glasses. The man's eyes were closed. One hand lay outside the coverlet, and Chuck observed the crescent-shaped scar on the back of it with no surprise. In this room, Chuck's grandpa, his Zadie, had seen his wife lying dead. The loaves of bread she would pull off the shelves when she went down scattered all around her.
"It's the waiting, Chucky," he'd said. "That's the hard part."
Now his own waiting would begin. How long would that wait be? How old was the man in the hospital bed? Chuck started back into the cupola for a closer look, but the vision was gone. No man, no hospital bed, no table. There was one final faint bip from the unseen monitor. Then that was gone too. The man did not fade as ghostly apparitions did in movies. He was just gone, insisting he had never been there in the first place. He wasn't, Chuck thought. I will insist that he wasn't, and I will live my life until my life runs out. I am wonderful. I deserve to be wonderful. And I contain multitudes. He closed the door and snapped the lock shut.